Hi, I'm Susan Schoeffer, your certified divorce coach and custody ally. This module is about the children and how to handle the children during divorce, locating a therapist for your children, and co-parenting. I want to talk a little bit about how divorce impacts children before we get deep into this module. Over the years, I've heard therapists and attorneys, teachers all comment about children are resilient. They do really well. As long as the parents work with the children, they seem to come out of the other side doing pretty well. And that may be true. But here's what I know. Even though children are resilient, children want both of their parents to be together. And even though they have two parents who are going through divorce, children see their parents as a unit, and that unit now is becoming divided. Children are also self-referential. So when their parents divorce, they wonder, well, what is it that happened? What went wrong? What did I do? How could I have stopped this? Could I have been smarter? Maybe I should have kept my room cleaner. Maybe if I had better grades. Maybe if I didn't eat junk food. Maybe if I was skinnier. They can't help it because developmentally, that's where their brains are. They are very self-referential. So that does come across their minds, all children. Some children appear to handle divorce better than others, but still waters can run deep. So it is sometimes the children who don't seem anxious, who don't seem depressed, who seem as though everything is okay and status quo, those are the ones where things are simmering underneath. While there are children who appear very anxious and they talk all about how they're upset and they wish their parents were still together and we assume that, well, they're a hot mess and maybe they are the ones that are handling the divorce better because they are able to emote. Or maybe it's flip-flopped, who knows? But here's what I do know. Divorce impacts children, and it impacts children in ways that we don't know. Very often people will tell me that their 7-year-old is so much happier, that mom and dad are not together anymore because they really want mom to be happy. I have to hide my grimace when I hear that. I have to almost act as though I didn't hear that because the 7-year-old is not happier for mom or dad now that they've split up and they can realize their best self. No, it doesn't work that way. Divorce is difficult for all children. Parents who normalize it and help the children get through it, sit down with the children, discuss what is happening, what is going to happen, assure them that both parents love them and the parents will work in their best efforts to make things easier for the children, those children do better. Parents who are warring, fighting with each other, pulling children in the middle, well, those children don't do as well. It doesn't matter how much I talk about the impact of divorce on children in the negative, no matter how much I talk about parental alienation and what that does to children, it seems as though there are those parents that, well, they can't help themselves. So I want to start with how this impacts children. I want to talk about what you can do. I want to begin with my credo, my mantra. I've said it so many times before, and it's splattered all through my guidebook, and that is, you can't change another person. You can only change how you behave. Focus on your behavior when it comes to your children. And I know that's difficult because the place where your partner, your spouse, your soon-to-be ex-spouse infiltrates is with the children. Taking care of yourself, finding the right attorney, figuring out your finances, those are all things that are about you, about the divorce, but the children are really ingratiated into the divorce. It impacts them. They get divorced too, just in a different way. Keep in mind that divorce is something that children don't have a choice. The decision is made for them. And yes, they don't have a choice about going to school. They don't have a choice about what you make for dinner. They don't have a choice about where you're going on vacation. So, suffice to say, they don't have a choice about divorce. But here's the difference. Divorce impacts them every single day of their lives. They wonder about, well, where am I going to go to school now? Who are my friends? Am I getting new friends? Do I have a new bed? Can I take the dog? Where does the dog go when I go back and forth between mom and dad? These are the things that flash in their mind. They think about, does mom and dad, who loves me more? Am I still lovable? We don't want to think that, but these are the things that go through their minds. They are impacted by divorce. One of the things that we wonder about with divorce is what really impacts our children. And we don't know. I've talked to hundreds of adults whose parents were divorced, and they tell me the littlest things that were the biggest things to them. A woman once told me that when her parents divorced, what was so upsetting to her was the drive to school every day. Her mom took her every day. Now it was going to be mom and dad. Mom and dad. Mom 1 week, dad 1 week, mom 1 week, dad 1 week. And that really impacted her. And here she was in her mid-40s telling me how that change in and of itself impacted her more than any other part of the divorce. And who would have thought about that? We just don't know. Routine. Routine changes. And that's what really rattles children. And think about that. We start very early with routine with our children. Feeding them at certain times. Diapering them at certain times. Nap time is a certain time. Bedtime is a certain time. They get a little older. They go to preschool. That's at a certain time. Snack is at a certain time. And they get very much involved in routines. And by the time you get divorced, the routine is shattered. Now they're going to live in two different places. To you, it may not make a difference if your ex-spouse is 10 miles away, but to your child, that could be 10,000 miles away. Their perception is very different than ours. So I want you to sit back and think about being in their shoes, how it impacts them, because it does. Look for things that may upset them that you don't know about. Have an open discussion with them. Ask them about their feelings. Listen to where they're going with things. And I know that that's difficult because we're so involved in our own part of our divorce. I mean, really? I see you nodding now. Really, Susan? Sit down and have a discussion with the kids? Well, yeah. Yeah. Be open with the children. One of the things that I want to share that I did with my children, and they would cringe to hear me share this, is when we had dinner every night, I asked them about the good part of their day and the bad part of their day. They're high and they're low. And some of you may already do this. This is nothing ingenious. To this day, they tell me they hated it. But at the time, they didn't seem to. And while a 9 and an 11-year-old or a 6 and an 8-year-old may not at dinner when you say, you know, so what was your low point today? Say something like, well, I'm really perturbed that things are different. And so it's highly unlikely that this will impact me. No, you aren't going to get that kind of discussion. But you can hear what's going on with school. You can hear what's going on with their friends, because it is those things that can lead you to understand where they are in their headspace. Are they getting more upset with their friends? Are things bothering them more at school? So that is just a little exercise that you can engage in every night at dinner. Just gives you an inkling of where they are. You may want to set a time, special time for each child. Maybe the Thursday night is the night that you have dinner with one child, and maybe that's the night that your spouse takes the other child. Carve out very specific time for each child. That doesn't mean you have to do anything major. That doesn't mean you have to take them to a five-star restaurant and then a show, but maybe it's a favorite cafeteria of theirs, or going to the park with them, or anything that they want to do that they just have you alone, because again, their world is shaken up. Another thing that I hear pretty consistently is, well, I love my children. I love my children, and as long as I love my children, everything is okay. Well, it is and it isn't, because I hear love all the time. I love my children. I've also been a private investigator long enough to tell you that people love their children. And they beat them. They neglect them. They leave them home alone. Yeah, well, maybe they love their children, but they surely aren't acting in the best interest of their children. What we provide to our children besides love is security. And divorce slashes their security. Divorce does not equal security. Divorce leaves them flailing, wondering. So this is the time that you need to make them feel secure. So I want to touch on, well, what can we do to make them feel secure? Wouldn't it be fabulous if both parents, you and your spouse, sat down with the children and discussed endlessly all the wonderful things that you were going to do to make them feel secure? Okay, I'm back to, you can't change another person. You can only change how you behave and how you react to them. I want to talk about the difference in parenting and how you have to respect that. Parenting differences become a real point of contention with divorcing parents. You may sit there and think, Susan, you're out of your mind. I don't know what you're talking about. My ex and I are going to do a great job of this, and I hope you do. But typically what happens, and I want you to keep an eye out for this, is that the differences in parenting may appear to become greater when you are separated. So the fact that on the girls' weekend, you used to hang out with your girls once a year, you all went to Las Vegas, your husband at that time would watch the children and let them stay up super late at night. And maybe that didn't bother you, maybe it did, but it wasn't a big deal. It wasn't a deal breaker. Now that you are in two different homes, if the weekends or weeks that your spouse has the children, he lets them stay up at all hours, now that may bother you more than it ever did. And that may become a thorn in your side. So what do I have to say to that? Well, it's too bad. You parent your way when you have the children, and he or she parents their way when they have the children. And if you don't like it, it's too bad. Now, if they are truly negligent, if they are leaving your 2- and 4-year-old home alone while they go out of town on the weekends that they have them, obviously you have to address that issue. You do. But if they let them eat a little bit more candy, or if they let them stay up later than you would, if dinner time is different, well, that's just too bad. And if you make a big deal of it, the children will get dragged into it, and you become worrying parents, and the children know that, and it makes it worse for the children, because the children can't do anything about the fact that their dad lets them stay up later. The children can't do anything about the fact that mom may make dinner earlier than dad. That's the name of the game, and you have to buckle down and recognize that. Because if you make anything else an issue, it will grow legs and become bigger, and you don't want to bring the children into it. And that's what typically happens. The children don't start to think, well, mom and dad have difference in parenting, and when I'm at mom's, we eat dinner a little earlier. Dad lets us stay up later at night. That's not how they see it, folks. That's not how it works. What happens is mom feeds us so early. I can't believe that. That is crazy. She's an idiot. Or dad lets us stay up all night. Oh my gosh, it's so much fun at dad's. That's how this is perceived. And while you and your ex are warring it out, your kids feel pulled into it. So recognize that there are just different parenting styles. Let your children work it out. I mean, if they are 15 or 14 or 17 and the time they are with their parent, the other parent, and you know he or she lets them stay up all night and then they fail exams, they will feel the pinch of that. They will start to recognize, wait a minute, I need to go to bed earlier. And it just is that way. One of my clients said to me a long time ago, I just can't stand the way he parents, and I'm going to do something about it. And I said, you're giving too much to this. Why? Spend the time with your children being the best parent you can be, and let your spouse do whatever it is that they do. Now, let's not talk about abuse, because abuse happens. And unfortunately, what I hear more of is my wife is negligent. She's abusive to the children. She doesn't let them play with their games. She's like an army sergeant. They have to be in bed at 10 o'clock at night. I'm going to talk to my attorney about this. I'm going to get custody. I'm going to take the children from her. She's horrible. Well, stop right there. She may be a little more militant. And unless she is stringing them up, hog-tying them, let it go. If she's militant about bedtime during her time, okay, then she is. This does not need to be an issue that goes back and forth to court. You have other issues. Let this rest. Try to co-parent as best you can and appreciate the differences in your parenting styles. Even in intact homes, even where there's no divorce, children know that one parent is more lenient than the other. One is more strict about bedtime. They get it. Parents are different, but they're still one unit. Now the unit is not one. It's been split, but to the children, their parents are still their parents, even though they go to different homes. They're still that one unit. So try to be as much of a one unit as possible. And co-parent the best way that you know how. So I want to go through some of the ways to co-parent the best that you can. These are in the guidebook and also in the module worksheets. I want to start with the most basic and the most difficult, and that is, do not badmouth the other parent. Your children want to love you both, and that's it. You may despise your wife. You may dream of her being flattened by traffic. And that's okay for you, but not to them, because to them, that's mommy. To them, that's their mother. To them, that's the person who used to cuddle them when they didn't feel well. To them, that's the person who was in the front row of the bake sale and had the best cupcakes. So don't badmouth that person. Don't make the children afraid of that person. You don't like that person? Go into your bedroom, go to your office, go in your car, call that person every name in the book without your children around. But don't do it in front of your children. Because if you do, they will feel anxious, and then they will feel like they can't love that other parent. Another way to co-parent well is if the other parent does or says something blatantly hateful to your children. For example, your daughter comes home and says, Dad says I'm really getting fat. Wow, what do you do with that? You know, your inclination is to pick up the phone and go, are you an idiot? You're calling her fat? She's going to have an eating disorder for the rest of her life. You're hideous. I hate you. I'm going to call my lawyer. You're never going to see her again. Yeah, I see you nodding. Mm-hmm. That's what you want to do, but you can't. So here's a lesson in life. You know, people are going to say things to other people that aren't nice. Would it be nice if dad didn't say that? Okay, but he did. So how do you not have a knee-jerk reaction to that? And how do you navigate that with your child or teach your child how to navigate through that? So you may want to say, you know what? That was not a nice thing to say. And you have every right to be hurt. I hear you. You have every right to be hurt. That was not nice to say to you, and you have every right. But I want to tell you, Dad did not mean to be mean. He does the best he can, and that hurts. And next time you see him, you may want to tell him that that hurt your feelings. Now, I know that this is a very cut and dry scenario, and not all of them will be like that. But I want to give you an example of when your children come home, they may say things how they perceive it. It may not have been said that way. Your ex-husband could have said, "You are so cute. Oh, you used to always be so roly-poly. You still have those little roly-polies." And your daughter may have heard that as dad said, "I'm fat." So there's a lot of perception that comes into this. There's a lot of who said what. You're not there to hear it. But if your child says something like that, don't join on the bandwagon. Well, you know what? Your mom is, well, she's an idiot. I hear it. You think she's in? Yeah, absolutely. Don't join in on that. Just address it as sanitized as you possibly can. This was said, it hurt your feelings. There probably wasn't malice. In fact, I know your dad wouldn't want to say anything to hurt your feelings. And let's talk about how you feel. Again, I know that this is a very isolated example. You probably have a whole list of them. But your job now is to co-parent and sometimes to ease the sting of what's going on the other side. And more importantly, when to decide if the other parent is truly being abusive or if they are just saying things that are ridiculous, idiotic in your view, and the ways that you can help your child navigate. This is also a learning curve for you, and it's a way to test your maturity and how you can act instead of reacting. So again, you don't have to ever agree with abuse or bad language. I'm not saying that if your spouse says something absolutely outrageous to your child, you have to say, "Well, you know what? Dad loves you, so that's okay." And that brings me to a little substrate of this. And that is, the courts will tell you that you always have to say, you know, your mom loves you, your dad loves you. And sometimes parents say things that don't sound like love. So if your ex-wife is saying something to your children like, "You're a slob, you are never going to amount to anything, you failed that Spanish test, you're a loser," you don't have to join in on that language. Those are hurtful words. And for every one time he or she says something like that, it takes about 1,000, "You're the greatest," to make up for it. So I'm not asking you to join on that bandwagon, but you can say things like, "You know, I know that your mom really loves you. Telling you that you're stupid and idiot and that you're not going to amount to anything is not the way love feels. That doesn't sound like love. I know she does. When she said that, she was probably angry, or maybe something else was going on with her, maybe something at her job. Maybe she had an argument with somebody else. I don't think she meant that, but I can tell you what she said is hurtful. It doesn't feel like love. And no, those aren't nice words." And then you can expand on that a little bit so that your child doesn't internalize what was said. At the same token, they still know that the other parent loves them. What was said was not acceptable, but you say it in a mature way so that they don't, again, internalize what was said to them. That's a huge order. In fact, if anything that I find the most challenging with co-parenting would be that component. When the other parent says things that are really hurtful to the child, and your lawyer and therapist are all telling you to say, "Well, they love you. They love you." And you just think, wait a minute. You don't want to have the child internalize it. And more importantly, you don't want them to hear words like that and think it's okay, because later on in life they start to date and then they get married, and you don't want them to be in a situation where their spouse talks to them like that and they just think it's second nature, and you know it's horrifying. So it's important that you understand the best ways to navigate around language that your children may come back to you with that they're hearing in the other home. And you know, it's a test in your maturity, and it's a tough one. This is the tough one. Another very important aspect on co-parenting is not to interfere with your spouse's visitation. Let me make this real clear. There's no wiggle room for this. Yes, there are times you will have the children and you are supposed to get them to your spouse's at, let's say, every other Saturday morning at 8 a.m. And you are scurrying around to get them ready, and you know, one of them falls and gets hurt. Okay, you may be late. Contact your children's parent and let them know what happened. Or you are supposed to get the child to a football game and it's for the other parent's visitation time. You're going to stay at the game anyway, and you hit terrible traffic. Notify your spouse what's going on. I'm talking about deliberate visitation infringement, and it happens all the time. Don't do it, because here's what will happen. If you have a divorce decree, and let's say you and your spouse have 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, and every other week or every 2 weeks, you are supposed to drop the children off on Sunday morning between 8 and 10 a.m. Don't even begin to try to, well, you know, I'm going to take them out to breakfast first, but, you know, I'm supposed to get them there between 8 and 10, but I'm going to take them to breakfast at 9:30, and I'll drop him off at them off at his house at like 11, 11:30, 12. Don't go there. And I'll tell you why you don't want to go there, because that is contempt of court. You're in contempt. You are defying the divorce decree. Your spouse may have had plans to take them to breakfast. You don't know what his or her plans were. You just haphazardly decide to take them to breakfast and infringe on the other parent's time. Not okay. And when you do that, the courts know exactly why you are doing that. That is not in the best interest of the child at all. If you want to take them out to breakfast on that Sunday morning, you have every right to do it. Do it between 8 and 10 and have those children at your spouse's house by 10. That's it. If you continue to violate visitation, your spouse will have the right to file contempt of court. And I can tell you, judges don't like this, because it's a blatant disregard for the court. First and foremost, you're in contempt. And second, they know why you're doing it. You're doing it to upset the other spouse, former spouse, ex-spouse, however you refer to them. They know, the judges know, that what you are doing is a deliberate act. So you are deliberately acting not in the best interest of the children, and you are deliberately in contempt of court. So what happens if you decide to do that? Well, you could lose custody. So if you have 50-50 legal custody, which is what happens in most states with divorce, and then you have 50-50 visitation, it's pretty liberal, pretty generous for both parents, and definitely is in the best interest of the children. But you infringe on your spouse's time with the children, which, by the way, the courts look at it as you're infringing on the child's time with that parent. Don't be surprised if the judge determines you don't have 50-50 custody any longer. The judge may decide, this person doesn't want to follow the rules. This person is in contempt. Let's take away their 50-50 custody, give it all to the other parent, And you can have visitation Wednesday nights and every other weekend. Maybe that's okay with you. I doubt it is. I'm not saying that's a bad schedule. It's a fabulous schedule. But if you've had 50-50 visitation, 50-50 custody all along, and you lose that because of your behavior, that's pretty tragic. Because if you have 50-50 custody with your divorce, that means that that's something you and your spouse both wanted. That you and your spouse both decided was in the best interest of your children, and now it's going to change. The judge is going to decide it's no longer in the best interest of the children for you to have 50-50 custody, and therefore the judge will make a decision. Now, you can visit them. And here's notching it up even worse. If you are saying things against the other parent and you are, you know, basically bad-mouthing the other parent, you could end up with supervised visitation. So what does supervised visitation mean? It means that you could literally visit with your children with a social worker sitting by your side. That means that when you visit your children on Wednesdays, there's a social worker, and on weekends, a social worker to assure that the children arrive on time and that you don't say anything disparaging. So by violating visitation, you really will take away your rights to the children and you will take away their rights to you. So if you need to be late bringing them to the other parent, let the other parent know that it's something out of your control and you will be there as soon as possible. Now, let me add a caveat to that one. Don't make a habit of that. And the courts are very savvy at seeing that habit. So if there are traffic patterns you have to consider, know what those traffic patterns are. Yes, there could be an occasional accident or work on the highway that precludes you getting the children exactly on time. But if you allow yourself enough time, that shouldn't happen frequently. And definitely don't make a habit of interfering with your spouse's visitation, because it can come back and really have a bad effect for you and your children. On the flip side of that, I want to talk about another area of co-parenting that's really important, and that is always be on time for your visitation. If you have to be late, let the other parent know as soon as possible. Somebody shared with me, one of them, and this is so sad, how her children used to wait at the window for Dad on Friday nights, and he was always late. He was supposed to come between 4:30 and 5 on Fridays, every other Friday. And the children's mother told me he was always late. She said at the end of the day, and her children were like 6 and 8 at the time, and she would say, Dad's coming, and he's coming to pick you up, and then you're going to go to dinner, and then you're going to Dad's for the week, yay. And she'd have them all packed up, and they would sit at the window, and 5 o'clock would come, and Dad was late, and Mom would say, well, maybe there was traffic, and 5:15, no word from Dad, Dad's not there. 15 minutes to you and me may be nothing. To children, it's a lifetime. Mom, where's Dad? And Dad'll be here, and 6 o'clock rolls around, 6:30. He's had dinner with business peers. Shows up at 8. The children are devastated. When you're late like that, they internalize it. Why was Dad late? What did I do wrong? Why doesn't Dad want to see me? Why does Dad always do this? Don't be late. Yes, there are circumstances that may cause you to be late. Contact your ex. Let them know. Talk to the children. Daddy can't help this. His boss pulled him into a meeting, but I'll be there as soon as possible. I can't wait to see you. If you have to cancel dinner plans, discuss that with your ex. You don't know what your ex is doing. You don't know if he or she has plans. Let them know. Just don't have children and an ex dangling waiting for you. Happens all the time. Happens all the time. Because sometimes a spouse gets angry and they kind of passively, aggressively, just are late, And this way, if the other spouse had a dinner date, well, now they don't. It's always about how can I get back at that spouse? But they're hurting the children. And the vision of those two children at the window just waiting pathetically for a parent that was late. Don't do it. It's cruel to the children. If you think you're hurting your spouse, you're making them angry, and maybe that's what you want to get. But you are hurting the children, and you do that enough times, and they internalize it. So please be on time. The last portion I want to discuss about co-parenting is physical and emotional abuse. What I hear frequently is, My ex-husband is so abusive to the kids. He should not be around them. And I'm going to go to court and see to it that he's not around. Be very careful about that. There are millions of children that are really abused, seriously abused, locked in bathrooms for hours, days at a time, beaten and burned. Food withheld from them. That's abuse. And if your spouse is doing that to your children, you need to immediately let the legal part of your divorce take care of this. You have to notify the police. Again, evidence. Make sure that you note everything, dates and times of when these things occur. And I discuss evidence, gathering evidence in the courts module. Make sure you have evidence before you accuse. And if your children are truly being abused, the police, their therapist, your attorney, maybe Child Protective Services will get involved. There are ways to address real abuse. True abuse. There are ways to protect your children if they are being neglected and abused by your former spouse. And that does happen. But here's what happens most of the time. One spouse is angry. They don't like the other spouse. They don't like the children being around the other spouse. They don't want the child to be around the new girlfriend or the new boyfriend. And they claim they're abusive. This falls a lot on the new love interest. I hear, Susan, I mean, he's a total jerk, but his new wife, I don't want her near the kids. You should hear what she says. She says terrible things. And she may or may not. Is that abuse? Probably not. You can work on how to navigate around that in a mature way. You can talk to your children about it in a healthy co-parenting way. Running to your attorney with, I have to get my children away from him and his new, she's crazy. She's crazy. She shouldn't be around children. You're not going to believe what she said. She told them that I'm ugly and I don't, that like my house is a mess. And my house is amazing. My house is so clean, you could eat off the floors. Well, okay. What do you want your lawyer to do with that? I mean, do you want to go to court for that? Do you want to spend time? But even if she says horrible things about you, that's not abuse. You may want to address it with your ex-spouse. Aaron came home and said that your wife said this. Your wife doesn't have to like me. Could you just ask her not to say that around my children, your children? I am their mom, and that's just disrespectful. And if you say it in such a way that it's not vindictive, I mean, what could he say to that? He may acquiesce and say to his wife, listen, back off. Or he may say, do some more of it. But that doesn't mean that they are abusing the children. So I want you to think very carefully before you use terms like abuse. You just can't do that. If they are really being abused, there are the proper channels. But don't just throw that terminology around because you are upset or you have a vendetta. I want to spend the rest of this module talking about getting your children into therapy because I really think that's important when people are going through a divorce. Why do I think that? Because isn't it great for children to have an unbiased adult to talk to? Yes, they can come to you and talk to you. You feel like, oh, my children can tell me anything and everything. And their other spouse feels the same way. But let's be honest, they don't. Not when it comes to divorce. The minute they talk to you about something other than school, the friends, whatever, they feel like they are betraying the other parent and vice versa. So therapy is really a nice, comfortable, soft place for them to land. An adult who understands psychology and children, family dynamics, divorce, what better place for them to be able to land and chat with somebody? Somebody who could guide them through these very turbulent waters. There are three types of mental health professionals that you can align yourself with, hire, that can help your children. One would be a licensed social worker. A licensed social worker is somebody who has a college degree, usually a master's degree, in social work. Basically, issues, administrative issues, or issues with social organizations, family health centers. They work with family dynamics, children in drug abuse. And they very often will have a specialty. So they may be a licensed social worker whose specialty is teen anxious behaviors, or they may have a specialty of working with children who have autism. These are individuals who very often are clinicians, so they can have an individual practice, and they will chat with your children and work on the issues that your children may be dealing with. I highly recommend that if you use a social worker, you find somebody who has a specialty in family dynamics, who has a specialty with children, working with children who are going through divorce, children's anxious behaviors, things that your children could encounter while they are going through the divorce with their family. I mean, it is a family life change. Social workers may not prescribe medication, but if a social worker sees something while they're treating your child, anxiety, behavior, depression, they can let you know and you can take your child to the pediatrician. And if medication is warranted, your pediatrician can write a prescription. So a licensed social worker is a possibility. The second possibility would be a clinical psychologist. That is somebody who has a doctorate, PhD, in psychology. They've spent clinical hours working in the field of psychology. Some of them are researchers, and they don't have practices. Those who have practices can treat your child. Now, again, like with a social worker, you want to find somebody whose specialty is families, divorce, anxious behaviors, anything that a child would encounter while they're going through divorce. Psychologists cannot prescribe medication, but like the social worker, if they detect something that's worrisome, where they feel your child could benefit from medication, they can then recommend that to you, and then you can take your child to your pediatrician, and the pediatrician can write a prescription. The third clinician you could take your child to is a psychiatrist. A psychiatrist is a medical doctor who, during their medical school training, specialized in psychiatric disorders. They can treat your child using chit-chat with them, just like a psychologist and a licensed social worker, and they can also prescribe medication. If you have a child that is already under the care of a psychiatrist or is already on medication, you may want to go this route. If your child has severe issues, mental health issues, a psychiatrist would probably be the best route to take from the beginning. I don't have a preference on any of the three. It's what you feel comfortable with. It's a person who has the specialty that you're looking for. somebody that your child feels comfortable with. With all three professionals, when they speak with your child, everything that they say to your child and your child says to you is confidential. So you are not taking your child to a mental health professional to then get a report after the child leaves. Oh, this is great. They're going to talk to the social worker, and then he or she's going to write me a report. I'm going to know everything. It doesn't work that way. What your child says to this person is confidential unless your child is doing something that's unsafe. So whenever you hire a mental health professional for your child, that's one thing they have to be willing to do. Almost all of them are, but double check when you interview them. So if your child says something to them like, I'm so depressed and I just feel like I want to kill myself, that therapist needs to let you know. If your child tells the therapist, I've been like so fat, I feel so fat, so like after I eat, I like go in the bathroom and I stick my finger down my throat and like I just throw up, and then it's not that bad, like I'm right at my perfect weight, but like my teeth are like killing me. That social worker needs to let you know. If you have a child that tells the social worker that they love guns and they're finding ways to collect them because they just love to feel a gun and they now have three under their bed, that therapist needs to be able to tell you. Some therapists feel as though they hear something like this, they don't have to tell the parent. They as a social worker, mental health professional, know how to deal with this, and they are going to work with the child and nip it in the bud. But the truth is, if you have a child who is binging, purging, pulling their hair out, cutting, taking drugs, vaping, sniffing drugs, sniffing alcohol, hiding guns under their bed. I mean, I don't want to scare you, but if they're doing any of these things, they may mention it to their social worker, their therapist on a Monday, but then they get in the car and go home with you. And if a therapist hears that your child is vomiting and their teeth hurt and they're dizzy and their throat hurts, they may not see your child for another week or 2 weeks. Well, they're sending your child home to possibly be in a dangerous place. This, it can impact their heart rate. That can be impact of their brain. I mean, there are a lot of things that can come out of these particular anxiety behaviors that you need to know about, especially if your child is exhibiting physical symptoms that should be looked at by your pediatrician. So you have to have that discussion up front with the social worker, because what you don't want is a tragedy. You don't want your child to go to school and brandishing a gun and you find out that the therapist knew that 6 months ago. No, it doesn't work that way. You have to have that open door policy with them discussing any dangerous behaviors with you early on. So that's a must. Now, I want to circle back here for a moment and discuss some of the things that you must address or you must have when you hire a therapist. This is also in the guidebook and in the module sheets, but I will go over them and elaborate on each one. First is the therapist must have a family practice. They have to understand family dynamics, and some therapists are not trained in that. If you go to a psychologist who has a practice, but basically it's about, you know, people who work in post-war operational whatever, obviously that is not going to be a therapist that can deal with family issues. So you want a family therapist. Somebody who understands dynamics of marriages, understands what happens when there's divorce, where conflict can arise, how to diffuse conflict. That's the person that you want. The therapist must understand age-appropriate developmental milestones, as well as pathologies of children. You're taking your child to a therapist, they have to understand where children are developmentally and where pathologies are. And not all therapists are alike when it comes to this. Some therapists just deal with teenagers. So taking a 7-year-old or a 5-year-old to a therapist whose specialty is teenagers and teenage behaviors may not be the best fit. So you want to make sure that the therapist that you hire for your children understand age-appropriate development and especially the pathologies that come with it. Teenagers these days, well, I sound very curmudgeon, don't I? Teenagers these days. However, some of the anxiety behaviors that teenagers have are very different than our generation. In fact, I remember when I took one of my children to college and they had the little chat with the parents the first day as you drop them off and they have the parents in the auditorium and they talk about everything from the dining hall to the dorms, but they address things like the counseling center. And this particular year, which wasn't that long ago, the provost brought in the school counselor, and the counselor talked about how anxiety was the new mental illness that they were seeing. 10 years prior, they were seeing depression. Now they're seeing anxiety. Well, children have anxiety generally. This seems to be the wave, okay? Anxiety. What does that mean? Well, I don't know. It means a lot of things. Cutting, drugs, can't sleep, insomnia, anorexia, bulimia. I don't know. There's a whole host of things that go on. And new ones crop up all the time. You want to make sure that your therapist understands that, knows that, is really in tune with what's going on. You don't want a therapist who says things like, you know, your daughter's really anxious. She's been cutting. You know what? This is like the new thing. I really don't know much about that. When my kids were growing up, that they didn't do any of this. No. You need a therapist who gets that, who knows that cutting is something that the kids do and it's prevalent, and they know how to recognize it and how to help a child work through that. So they must understand age-appropriate milestones. A therapist that you hire must understand the dynamics of divorce and the impact it has on children. And you may say, well, of course they do. Well, not necessarily. Some therapists work with children who live in poverty situations and have PTSD from gang violence. Well, that's fantastic because there are children who are in those untenable situations who need therapists who specialize in that, but that may not be the best pick for your child. You need a therapist for your child who understands divorce, knows how children feel when they go through divorce, and to help them navigate through it. The therapist you hire must understand the role of a best interest attorney. What is a best interest attorney? I talk about it in the module about courts. A best interest attorney, also known as a guardian ad litem, is a person who is appointed by the court, a person who is an attorney, has a law degree, who is assigned to work with the children. They meet with the children, talk with the children. They determine what's in the best interest of the children, who the children should live with, if one parent is preferred based on the attorney's assessment. And the best interest attorney or guardian ad litem will be able to help the parents through custody issues and determine how custody best works for that particular child or children. The other role of the best interest attorney, oftentimes, is to make certain recommendations to the court. And when the parents are contentious, the role of the best interest attorney is greater. And it escalates and becomes stronger the more the contention escalates. What often happens is the best interest attorney will subpoena, which means they get a court order to have your children's therapeutic records available for a judge to see. Now, it's not just their therapeutic records. It may be school documents, school records, school report cards, letters from coaches, interviews with coaches or dance teachers or neighbors or pediatricians, dentists, orthodontists. I mean, it's not just the therapist. But they do get those records from the therapist. And those are the records the parents often struggle with, and understandably so. Here, you take your child to a therapist, somebody unbiased, a person they can trust, somebody they can trust during a period of their life where their trust may be shattered or altered or compromised. And now you're going to court, and these private records are going to be out there for everybody to see. Your therapist must understand that there are therapists who will not see your child if they know that the possibility of a guardian ad litem best interest attorney will be brought into the case, because they do not want to reveal records. And they will tell you, well, I would love to take this on, but I don't want to, because I don't want to have to reveal records. Then there are those therapists who go, okay, there are the records and there are the records. So they will have two sets of records. They will have the ones where your children discuss the deep, dark bowels of their existence. And then there are the bullet point notes. It is the bullet point notes that they will turn over to the best interest attorney. Have this discussion beforehand with a therapist. What you don't want to happen is your child has a therapist. They love the therapist. They are doing so well. They are going through the divorce healthy and happy in a way that you didn't think was possible. And then boom, here comes the best interest attorney. And your child's 13 or 14, 15, they've been just so happy with their therapist. And now the therapist has to turn over all the records to a best interest attorney. It goes to court. Your child finds out everything they talked about for the past 3 years is in the hands of the judge. Wow, that feels to the child like an unbelievable betrayal. And it kind of sort of is. Can you imagine you go to a therapist and your records are turned over? Everything you talked about, from your first kiss to, oh my gosh, maybe you had sex, to you can't stand your best friend, but even though they're your best friend. I mean, can you imagine how that feels to a teenager? Discuss this ahead of time with the therapist, how this is handled. Don't let it get sprung on them. It's not fair to them, and it surely is not fair to the child. Let the therapist tell you how they handle best interest attorney situations. Because if you hire a therapist for your child who specializes in divorce, understands the dynamics of divorce, they are very clear about what a guardian ad litem best interest attorney is. And they have ways to tiptoe around that, so to speak. So address it firsthand. And by the way, if you are interviewing a therapist and you mention a best interest attorney and they don't know what that is, you need to leave right away, because that is very much a common element in divorce. And if they don't know what that is, that's going to be problematic. So no matter how much you like them, you need to walk away from them. You must have a therapist who understands the role of a best interest attorney and how to navigate around it when treating your child. Another must that your therapist or any therapist that you hire needs to have, and that is an understanding of domestic violence, especially if there has been domestic violence in your family. They need to understand what it is and the impact. They need to understand that pushing your child down the steps is not okay. So if your ex is pushing, shoving, hitting, slapping your children, the therapist needs to have an understanding of the impact that that has on children, and that they can help your children with that. And more importantly, if they see signs of domestic violence that you don't even know about, that they know how to take the appropriate channels. If your child is really being beaten up or abused by your ex-spouse, the therapist's recommendation to the courts, or the therapist's contacting Child Protective Services or any other authority has a lot more credibility than if you do it, because you can be perceived, even if you're not, you can be perceived as vindictive, a spouse that can't get over her husband, or a spouse who can't get over his wife, or you're using the child as pawns. And believe me, that happens all the time, which is why the courts see it that way. But if this third party comes in and says, you know what, mom or dad never said anything to me, but this child says that mom takes out a ruler and beats them. The credibility goes through the roof. So you want to have somebody who understands domestic violence and who can detect it. Sometimes it's very covert and it's very hard to find any kind of abuse, but a good therapist knows how to uncover that. So again, must understand domestic violence. The therapist you hire must provide consistent therapy. And that means you set up a schedule. If it's going to be every month, that same day of the month. If it's a Monday, every Monday, once a month. If it's Thursday afternoon, every Thursday afternoon, once a month. If it's every 2 weeks on the same day, same time. If it's every week, same day, same time. Now, therapists usually love that. They like to have a specific schedule. You're penciled in for that day or penned in for that day and time. But it's really important for your children. Remember I talked about schedules a little bit earlier in this module? Children like that. Even when they go, what are you talking about, mom? I don't want to go to bed at 10 o'clock. Okay, we get that. But they really do like schedules. And if your child is struggling with something on a Thursday and they know they have their therapist on Monday, they are looking forward to that. They're not telling you, but they are. They know in the back of their mind they can save it for their therapist and discuss it then. You start pulling up their visits and moving them around. That really rocks their world in a negative way. So stay consistent with the therapist and make sure your therapist is like that. There are, like I said, most therapists love that. They have a book open and they have what they call their standing appointments. They love it. They know those people are coming in on those days and they know that therapy only works when it's consistent. But there are some out there that sort of like a devil may care kind of way, whenever, you know, and that's fine for their practice. It won't work with your children. So find somebody who really appreciates a consistent therapeutic schedule. The most important attribute that a therapist must have, and that is their willingness to betray your child's confidence only in the event that your child is doing something unsafe. And that is taking drugs, cutting, eating disorders, alcohol use, thoughts of suicide, thoughts of homicide. Any of these things that surface between the child and the therapist, you know, your child conveys these feelings or these actions that they're already participating in, therapists must be willing to tell you. You cannot be held in the dark. If your child is operating a prostitution ring, you need to know that. If your child is vaping and taking Oxy, you have to know this. If your child has been cutting behind their kneecaps, you have to know this. You are a custodial parent. This is a minor. This is a child. And if they are doing anything that is dangerous to themselves or others, you have to know this. If your child is telling their therapist that, like, they hate their best friends and they hate you and you're such a bitch, and their dad, they hate his girlfriend, you don't have to know any of that. And they can ramble on with their therapist about that until whenever, and you don't care. It's a big deal to your kid, and the therapist is listening and helping them navigate through things that are just teen things, okay? Or young child thing. Fantastic. If your child is talking about, you know, a new crush, or they hate a teacher, this is things that the therapist can help the child with. The therapist can walk them through how to address things in a mature manner, how to look at both sides of an equation. This is wonderful. Your child comes to them with really scary things, you need to know about it. And that's final. Therapists can't come to you and say, about 9 months ago, your daughter told me about cutting, but we were working through it as your daughter is hooked up to life support because you found her in a pool of blood in the bathroom. That can't fly. They have to be willing to betray your child on those circumstances. And they're not betraying the child. They're helping the child, and in many cases, helping save their lives. So you have to really drive that thought home, because there is that very thin line. I mean, when we think about some of these tragedies where somebody comes in and they blow up people in a movie theater, or they come into a school, oftentimes you'll hear parents say, I had no idea. And maybe they didn't, that their children were stockpiling weapons in their bedroom closet. I don't know. But wouldn't it be a tragedy for some kind of horrible situation occur, and as the investigation ensues, we find out that the therapist knew all about this for 9 months, 10 months, 6 months, and told no one. Come on, that can't be. You can divert a tragedy if everybody's on board. So again, the therapist must be willing to betray the child only. And when I say betray the child, betray their confidence, or what would be considered betray their confidence. And only in the event that the child is using drugs, alcohol, showing suicidal thoughts, homicidal thoughts, anything that can hurt themselves or hurt another person. Now, tiptoe on this. You are not to kind of check in with a therapist, about the boyfriend that you don't really like for her, or has your son had sex yet? Is he sharing that? Because you kind of want to know. No, that's not what this is about. Not that kind of betray of confidence. Only if the child is being dangerous to themselves or others, or think about being dangerous to themselves or others. So you've been given lots of information. This has been extremely comprehensive. Children really do present challenges with divorce. They didn't ask for divorce. They're forced into a situation they don't want. Children want to love both parents. They want to live with both parents. People tell me all the time, my children are so much better now that my husband and I aren't together anymore. There was just such tension in the house, and now it's so much better. And you talk to the children, and sometimes they say, in fact, many times they say, you know what? I didn't really know there was tension. Or, okay, it wasn't that bad. I just like them to be together. Children feel that way. They do. It's hard for you to hear that, but they do. Their world is shaken. Their security is a little wobbly. They wonder about trusting. It's a complete shift for them, psychologically and emotionally. And it's your job and your spouse's job to make this transition as fluid and as drama-free as possible. Isn't that a panacea? It is, because that's not typically how it works out, which is why I've done this module. If every parent sat down, if both parents sat down with children and said, we're going through a divorce, but your dad and I were the best of friends, and things are going to be great, and here's all these wonderful things we're going to do. This module would be about 5 minutes, but that's not how it works. And you will rub up against some challenges when it comes with your children and divorce. They will tell you things, or you will hear things, you will see things that you just never thought. If you have little children now, they are going to grow into adolescents and teenagers in a divorced home, and they will have challenges that maybe some of their peers don't have. So it's imperative that you and your spouse think about what's in the best interest of the child and act accordingly. And I know the information in this module is imperative and very helpful. So keep your children healthy, stay above the contention, do what's in their best interest. They will appreciate it, and they will turn out as healthy adults for it.